It is a center for higher learning.
It is a place with centuries of secrets in its shadowed halls.
This is where you have come to learn the mysteries of the cosmos.
Welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast.
They'll teach you things you can't unlearn.
Hello, and welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast, episode 149. This is the podcast dedicated to Call of Cthulhu and other horror and Lovecraft-related role-playing games. I'm Keeper Murph.
And I'm Keeper Chad, and this episode we have the fourth and last installment for Women in Tabletop Gaming Month.
That's right, I talked to writer and game designer Becky Annison about the game Lovecraft-esque, among other topics.
That sounds great, and I'm Keeper John. And this episode we won't be catching up on the Campus Crier, but we will be back with news and feedback and other stuff for our upcoming sesquicentennial episode.
And once again, check out the Women in Tabletop Gaming Month website to hear more interviews, as well as Lynn Hardy's blog series on women creatives who contributed to Chaosium over the years.
And now into the main topic.
Settle down now, class. It's time for your next lesson.
This is Keeper Murph from Miskatonic University Podcast, and today I'm talking with Becky Annison from Black Armada and Lovecraft-esque fame. How are you, Becky?
I'm really good. How are you?
Good. So we wanted to have you on the show, and the other guys wanted to be here, but everything falls through when you got three guys on a weekend. It's kind of hard to make it. But we wanted to have you on because of Lovecraft-esque, and you're kind of in the horror gaming realm, and you've got a lot of indie things going on, and it seemed like a perfect fit.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. So my first question, I guess, is how did you get into gaming in general?
Oh, wow. Gaming in general. I started gaming, I think it depends whether you count HeroQuest, the board game, as your first.
That was my first as well, to be honest.
I was about six or seven when I started playing HeroQuest, the board game with my best friend.
There you go.
So if that counts as the start, then I think that's it. I think proper role-playing, because I don't really consider HeroQuest the board game to be proper role-playing. I read a book when I was 11, which was a short fiction novel, which was all about this thing called Dungeons & Dragons and how awful it was, because how it ripped apart a friendship group and how dangerous it was. And I'm sure it was like an offshoot of the Satanic Panic. But I remember reading this book and thinking, wow, that sounds like fun. I should get into that. And that year, after I'd read the book, when I got my birthday money, my 11-year-old birthday money, I went straight out and bought D&D.
That's fantastic. So the Satanic scare scared you right into the game.
Absolutely. I thought, wow, anything that's kind of that gripping and that imaginative, I'm going to do that. That sounds great.
So how long did you play just D&D before you branched out? Because it seems like when you're that age, at least for me, when I was that age and I got into D&D, I was focused on D&D and didn't do anything else, mainly because I just didn't know anything else existed.
No, I was in exactly the same position. I played D&D up until I was 17. And then I made a new group of friends who were more heavily into role-playing than my previous group of friends. So I spent more time hanging out with them. And they introduced me to, I think the first game after that was Amber Diceless. And Amber Diceless still has a really, really important place in my heart even today.
That makes sense, though, actually, given what you've done so far, that Amber Diceless is kind of held on high esteem there, you know?
It's a joke among my friendship group that Becky doesn't like dice. And that's not entirely true, but there was a little bit of truth in it. A little bit.
Maybe a little bit more than a little
bit. Maybe a little bit more. Maybe a little bit.
Did you run games for D&D?
I ran a little bit of D&D, but not a lot. My experience in writing and running games came a lot later when I was at university. And the first thing I did was join the University Role Playing Society, which was a fabulous home for me. And they did a lot of live action role playing. And every year they would run something called the Society Game, which was this live action role play, which was written completely fresh system, fresh setting every single year. It ran for a year with a different team of GMs, and it varied depending on how popular it was. But we had anything from 20 to 60 people at any one time playing that game.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Impressive.
It was huge amounts of work. I did 2 years worth of running the society game. This is Oxford University Role Playing Society. And, you know, there is no better place I've found to kind of learn the craft of writing mechanics and testing them in a live situation with a bunch of people who are there to have fun and who are there in many cases to support you. And it's just like this amazing hothouse, I felt, of here's how you do game design.
That's amazing. I'm trying to think out the logistics in my head of 60 players. I mean, even with multiple GMs, though, you had to have had like a co-GM there on site to try and keep track of the lore as it was coming up. You know, the things that just a note taker almost just to,
it was intense. But I mean, we were students. What else were we going to do?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, nothing better. Fantastic. So you went to Oxford, obviously.
Yeah, I went to Oxford. That's where I met Josh Fox, the other half of Black Armada. And a lot of my good friends now who still do game design and who still do a lot of role playing and a lot of creative work, they're all kind of people I met through Oxford University Role Playing Society. So shout out to them now, although they're full of amazingly creative people who I've never met now because they're all 20 and I am not 20 anymore.
I know the feeling. The gray in my beard gives it away, even though I don't feel it. Whenever they would start up a new campaign every year, was it a new system that they would create on the fly every year?
Yeah, it was a bespoke system created each year for each game.
That's amazing. Were they primarily, like, for instance, when you did it, were you anti-dice at the time or coming right out of D&D, did you do it with dice or?
It was a live action game, so there wasn't a whole lot of dice in any of the incarnations, although there were sort of various different points. I think people created little subsystems for determining how things might go out of. So we used to have a system called turn sheeting, which is that you turn up, you play your character for a couple of hours, and then over the next 2 or 3 days, you write down the actions your character wants to take in the game, you know, in line with the system that had been created. And then the GM team would get together and they would take all of the turn sheets in and we would discuss the outcomes of all of the actions. And then at the start of each new session, you would have like a mini debrief about what happened in your turn sheet to inform your role playing for the next session. And so sometimes you create little subsystems with dice to determine how some of those actions fell out, but often you just use a straight stats system and things like that. It was amazing. It was an amazing thing to be part of.
And how long were you involved with that?
So I was at the university for 3 years, and two of those 3 years, I think I was mostly on the GM team of one of two campaigns, year-long campaigns. And then I stayed on for an extra year to do my law school. And then I stayed on for a kind of a gap year, and then that was it. And I was off.
Awesome. I guess at that point you were actually writing your own games, but when did you decide to try and write these games for more people, you know, for a broader audience, as opposed to just the group that you're a member of?
I think, to be honest, it was a few years after I discovered Fiasco. And I think the reason was because although I'd done all of this work in LARP, I kind of felt like, well, that's LARP. LARP is LARP. It's a separate thing. And, you know, if you want to break into role-playing writing, you need to be looking at writing something like D&D, which is a textbook. And I just couldn't imagine myself sitting down and writing things like encumbrance tables or incredible lists of weapons and things like that. And I just thought to myself, you know, I just don't think I've got the stamina to do that. And so for the longest time, I thought to myself, well, you know, I've done this lovely stuff in LARP and it's been great and it's been fun, but I'm never going to go do role-playing writing because that's a different beast and it's not where my talents are. And then things like Fiasco came out by Jason Morningstar. And I looked at that and I went, wow, this is a really interesting role-playing game with no encumbrance tables. It's got other sorts of tables in it, but they look, you know, they're not encumbrance tables. I could do something like that. I could maybe do that. And the first game that I wrote that was published by Palgrave Press before Lovecraft S came out was called When the Dark is Gone, which was a short, it's about 10,000 words, I think. It's anybody who reads it says, you didn't write a tabletop, Becky. You just wrote a LARP and made people sit down for it. And that is a bit true. That is true. it's a stealth LARP.
Stealth LARP.
Yeah.
That's great.
But I think that was the first time that made me think that role-playing writing and role-playing game design no longer had to fit into this mold of D&D. And once that door had been unlocked in my mind, then I was like, oh no, hang on, I can do this. I can write games. I can write systems and mechanics. I don't have to write kind of a list of 300 merits and flaws to write the game that I need to write.
When did your lesser half come into that as well? Has he always been a part of that? And because I know he does a lot of indie games as well, but for a long time he was dice only.
Yes. No, he's always been a part of that. We met doing LARP at Oxford University Role Playing Society. We have always continued to run games and play games together. And then we kind of discovered Fiasco and things at the same time. And I sort of said, oh, I've got an idea for a game like Fiasco, but with no conflict resolution mechanic. And he said, oh, that won't work, Becky. And I said, oh, yes, it will. You know, so part of writing When the Dark is Gone was to prove a point, really. But I mean, I think that around the same time he wrote a game called Disaster Strikes, which is on the Black Armada website. And that was very kind of an early version of kind of his gaming trajectory. And so really, we do it, you know, it's a thing that we do together. We live in this kind of, somebody else called it like a live dev environment. Just before I came on this podcast, he stopped me and said, which of these two front covers do you think looks the best for when you game? And I was like, I'm about to go on a podcast. But that's what life is like, you know, in between kind of dealing with the toddler and, you know, taking the 5-year-old to school and stuff, they'll be kind of, I'm not sure this mechanic is working. What would you do with that?
What a life, though. I mean, I have to admit, I'm kind of envious. It seems you've met the perfect person for another gamer, though. You know, you're like the perfect power gamer couple.
I feel it is both a blessing and a curse because it means that I always have somebody who is completely supportive of my hobby, which is a very consuming hobby for me. He's completely supportive, as I am completely supportive of him. If I say, I'm going gaming 3 nights a week, and he says, that's fine. I'm gaming 3 nights a week as well. Are we in the same games at any point? And I'll go, yeah, we're in this game on Sunday and that sort of thing. And it's the worst thing in the world because it means you can never switch off from it. If you've had a really exhausting day and all you want to do is put Brooklyn 99 on or whatever and just veg out, then maybe that's okay. But maybe actually you're just going to get drawn into a discussion about mechanics and probability curves and things like that. So
when you're trying to veg out in the bed at night and you're just staring at the ceiling, hoping nobody brings up, you know, where's Lift Gates? There it is.
Exactly.
So what got you into trying to segue into Lovecraft Esque here, but what got you into more of the horror gaming, with the darker stuff, I should say?
So I've always enjoyed horror. I've always enjoyed the stories of H.P. Lovecraft and, you know, various horror movies. My favorite film of all time is Aliens. And so it's always been kind of a thing that I've been interested in. The reason that we wrote Lovecraft Desk was because I read Stealing Cthulhu by Graham Walmsley.
Mm-hmm.
Have you read Stealing Cthulhu?
I have.
I think it's a brilliant book. I really loved it. I was kind of noodling around some ideas about some H.P. Lovecraft games I might run, maybe using Trail of Cthulhu or similar. And I thought, well, I'll read Stealing Cthulhu because I've always been interested in H.P. Lovecraft. And I want to see what Graham has, how he has distilled the fiction of H.P. Lovecraft into, I suppose, a formula, if you like. So for those of you listeners who aren't familiar with it, Stealing Cthulhu is a book about how to run Call of Cthulhu or Act on Cthulhu or Trail of Cthulhu or any Cthulhu game, but in its kind of its most purest form, I suppose. But and Graham breaks down the beats of H.P. Lovecraft stories and says, well, the horror builds up in a very specific way and it's resolved in a very specific way. And this is how you can use that trajectory in your games to give your games a really authentic feel. And so I read the book and I loved it. And as soon as I finished it, I just turned to Josh and I said, Graham's written the blueprint for an indie GM-less H.P. Lovecraft game here. Why hasn't he written the game? And Josh said, what do you mean? And I said, okay, read Stealing Cthulhu and see what you think. And he read Stealing Cthulhu and he said, Becky, we should write this game. And then we did. And I feel kind of in many ways that Lovecraft Deaths is a little bit of a cheat because although Graham didn't write the game, he is absolutely the grandfather of the game. And if you read Stealing Cthulhu, that, you know, mapping out how you would run a GM-less Lovecraft game, a lot of it is in there.
Did you ever play Graham's Cthulhu Dark?
No, I haven't, but I've got a copy. We backed the Kickstarter and we got the leather-bound copy. And I'm really, really keen to run.
You should. It's a lot.
To run a Cthulhu Dark game.
It's a lot. There's a lot of room for messing with each other. I should say. I'm notorious when I play with my friends, you know, with people. The other Keeper Chad on this podcast is a huge fan of Walmsley, and he ran me through my first Cthulhu Dark scenario at Gen Con back in like 2013, I think. Or 2014, and it was amazing. I absolutely fell in love with it. But yeah, it's a great system. Should definitely run it.
And there's not too many dice in it, I hear. So
very, very, very minimum. you'll enjoy that aspect of it.
It's absolutely on my list of every year I try and think the games that I want to read and the games that I want to run. And it's on the 2018 games I want to run list. So hopefully it'll make it to the top.
So at what point did you finish writing Lovecraft Desk and decide, you know, I think we can make money at this? Because at some point you had to decide, like, this is not just a hobby. I'm gonna kickstart this, or I'm gonna try and get funding for this in one way or another, and actually make a dime off of it. So at what point did that come around, and what kind of brought you to that decision?
So we wrote the game bizarrely quickly in that I bought a copy of Stealing Cthulhu at Dragon Meet, which would have been around about the first weekend in December, and we were playtesting at the end of January.
Wow.
Did our first playtest at the end of January. And I to do this day, I do not know how we managed to do that with a 2.5-year-old in our lives. I suppose every time he went for a nap, we must have been like, Rick, quite, get the paper out, get the pens out. You know, let's get this stuff down. Yeah, we wrote it really fast. And I remember we, sometime in January or early February, I remember going for a walk with the toddler in the pram and talking about what we were going to do with it. And I remember Josh saying, I think we should kickstart it. And me saying, how can we possibly do that? This is ridiculous. We can't possibly do that. And he really pushed it and said, no, we really have to kickstart this. And I said, all right, then, let's do it. Let's kickstart it. And so, yeah, that was, you know, that push was absolutely from Josh, and he was completely right to do it. I think he had more faith in us than I did, maybe.
Had either of you ever run a Kickstarter at that point?
No.
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 Had either of you ever written professionally at that point?
I had written When the Dark Is Gone for Palgrave. Maybe it hadn't been picked up by them at that point, actually. I had written that, and I had not intended to publish it anywhere other than the Black Armada website, which is where it was. I think possibly it wasn't until the summer that Kat Tobin got in touch with me about that. So maybe actually neither of us had written professionally at the point at which we were doing that. Yeah, I think that might be right.
How did you find that experience of running a first-time Kickstarter? Because a lot of people don't find it fun.
I think we did find it fun.
Did you?
To give you a bit of background, so Josh, for a long time, he was a program manager. So the idea of kind of plotting out a Kickstarter and running it like a program and then running the fulfillment that angle, you know, with the critical path analysis and all of that sort of thing. That was something I think he was very comfortable with. At that point, I did an MBA as part of my previous job. And so kind of thinking about it as a business proposition and looking at things like profit margin and how all the different Kickstarter tiers contribute to a profit margin in different ways and things like that. I think we were both quite comfortable with that. So in some ways, the kind of business side of it, although we'd never done anything quite like it before, I think we had some skills from our jobs, which made that a little bit easier than maybe other people have found it.
I'd imagine so. So you guys basically Gantt charted it all out with ROIs everywhere and managed to come out on the other side without any problems.
Well, pretty much. I mean, it wasn't quite as, there were a lot of spreadsheets involved. I will say that there were a lot of spreadsheets, but yeah, so that angle of it, we were fairly comfortable with, you know, and we had lots of things diarized and felt like we had to do that because we delivered the Kickstarter when I was 8 months pregnant with our second child, maybe 9 months. Pretty close to the end.
Wow, that's.
We were in the delivery phase at the same time at which she was pretty newborn. I seem to recall, so we had to be fairly on top of things. But yeah, so the Kickstarter itself, I think we just found it kind of we were a bit stunned. I had half a mind of thinking, well, nobody's going to know who we are particularly. You know, we hang out on G+ and talk about gaming, but you know, I'm not particularly prolific in posting. No one's going to know who we are. So it probably isn't, you know, we might scrape by if our friends kind of back it and put it on their Facebook. But, you know, I didn't expect it to do as well as it did. But because we funded really quickly, I think we funded within the first day or two. After that, it was just fun because you didn't have the stress of thinking, oh, gosh, this isn't going to fund. So you could just, it was quite exciting and exhilarating.
That's fantastic. I remember when we found out about it, we found out through, I think, a Google+ post that someone had put. I'm not sure who or how, but it got back to us. And I remember us covering it on the show when it was still live.
And yeah, thank you.
Do you have any advice out there for anybody else who's wanting to do a Kickstarter and thinks that they'll be able to do it?
I think that everybody has the potential to be able to do a Kickstarter. I am internally grateful for Josh saying to me, let's just do it, because I think that my reticence would have meant that it would never have happened, and that would have been a great shame. So I think the first thing I'd say to people is, you know, get over the sense that you feel you're not good enough and try, because the worst thing that's going to happen is your Kickstarter won't make the money and then you won't make a loss particularly, you know. And if your Kickstarter fails, there's still nothing that stops you putting it out on the internet and getting a following going in another way. So yeah, I think that I would definitely encourage people to try it. I think the thing that I would say is you need to treat it like a business, and you need to run the numbers and run them again and run them again. So, you know, I don't want to get, I know Josh has written quite a lot on the Black Armada website, really breaking down how we did it, and particularly in terms of the numbers. So I would encourage people to read that, because it probably isn't as straightforward as people think how to do the numbers for a Kickstarter. Make sure you pay yourself, I would say, for your time. We definitely put aside some money for paying ourselves. We had a 10% contingency fund, which was almost completely eaten up by Brexit.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So when we started the Kickstarter, Brexit wasn't a thing that anybody thought was ever going to happen. And even though we thought it was never going to happen, in our Kickstarter numbers, we had allowed for a 10% fluctuation in currency.
Right.
Because so many of the people we were working with for delivery were based in America. We've built a contingency fund in on top of the currency fluctuation, I think, but we had allowed for a currency fluctuation. And then the Brexit vote happened when we were in the middle of delivery. So suddenly our Kickstarter was based on one set of currency estimates, and our delivery was now based on a completely different set of currency estimates. And that ate up £600, I think, which tanked our contingency fund. So I would say thank you very much to Anna Kreider, who recommended we have a 10% contingency fund. She was bang on about that, even though you know, Brexit wasn't even on the horizon at the time.
Did you find yourself in a situation with shipping was concerned with going to the US and overseas?
No, we were okay on shipping, actually. We'd put in some good estimates on shipping. And I'm not really sure. Shipping is a bit of a funny thing, isn't it, with Kickstarters? Certainly from Britain out to get outside of Britain doesn't seem to be as expensive as it is to get from a product from the US into Europe.
Correct. And it seems like it's much cheaper to get from Britain to the continent than it is to get from Britain to the US or to Canada.
Yeah. But also we chose to use a publishing house, We used a printer who had operations based in the UK and in the US. So you could print in either location and ship from either location. And so that was the thing we did to cut the shipping costs as well.
That's brilliant, because a lot of people don't do that or aren't aware that that's going to be as big of a problem. It seems like most people who come at a Kickstarter the first time around for a printed product, they forget about shipping international, or they just don't have enough of a buffer in there for fluctuation in prices for shipping international.
And it's a hard thing. I think there's a lot of number crunching that goes on behind Kickstarters behind the scenes that most people don't get to see. And certainly one of the things that Josh did when we were preparing our Kickstarter is that he looked at like the top 10 indie Kickstarters and did a fair bit of analysis on, you know, where they were putting their costs and what they looked like and things like that to try and make ours map the best model that we could.
I'm assuming that you guys also took into account the add-ons and things like that that would end up increasing your costs and then shipping costs ultimately.
Yes. Yeah.
You have an interesting origin though, because you started in this environment of the Oxford Gaming Society where you were basically creating freeform games from day one. It's kind of odd. Do you have any advice for anyone else out there who would like to kind of break into the industry to try and see what they can, or to get a story out that they might want to? Is there anything that you could tell someone who's just listening who might want to do that?
Yeah, I think that the first thing I would say, and I would say this to anybody, is that you need to play games. You need to play a lot of games, and preferably a lot of different types of games. And because no matter what brilliant idea you have for mechanics in your head, no game survives contact with the players. But you will have a better idea of how your game won't survive contact with the players if you've done a lot of playing.
Right.
So that's the first thing I would say, to get your design as sharp as possible, play a lot of different systems. And I do it even now. I'm about to go into a D&D 5th edition campaign because as a designer, I haven't read D&D 5th edition yet. And I want to know what's going on with that. Is a lot of dice, you know, I understand that going in. but, you know, playing games, which aren't in my sweet spot, I like to do that because I like to understand how different mechanics work. And the other thing I would talk about is the importance of playtesting, which is in a similar vein, goes back to the same thing I just said, which is no system survives contact with the players. It doesn't matter how many simulations you run in your head about what you think your mechanics are going to do. It won't be till you get around the table and see people using them and see people abusing them that you will really understand your game. And so that's really hard. Getting playtesting, a really good amount of playtesting done in your games, is a really hard thing to do.
And I think a lot of people kind of sidestep a lot of that. Like, they don't playtest quite as much as they probably should, just because it is kind of difficult to get enough different people to run the game or be a part of the game that you're running, or have someone else run it while you just observe. You know, it's a lot of planning that has to go on in order to get that done and then record it properly.
Yeah, and you are right, and it's absolutely true. But I mean, with Lovecraft-esque and with all of the other games that we've put out and will put out in the future, we run it ourselves, our friends run it, and then we try and get it run by somebody who is not in our social circle, somebody we don't game with particularly, so that we are not unconsciously transmitting through our culture of play something which actually isn't in the rules. I think that's really important, and that's something people don't realise a lot, is that when you design a game, if you're the only person playtesting it, then there's almost certainly some thing you're doing which is actually should be in the system, which you don't realize you're doing. And if you can get somebody who is not in your social group to run it and report back to you, then, you know, if you're lucky, you'll catch it and be able to just make your system design as sharp as possible. So yeah, so my first thing would be play a lot of games. My second thing would be run a lot of games. And then I think just to think about the sort of space that you want to design in. So I have written things for other systems and other games. I've written some things for Hill Folk and some other bits and pieces. And I do enjoy that. And I think it's really good to have that on your game designer's CV. I think particularly as a woman or as a non-binary person or as any sort of marginalised person, being able to say that you have done work with one of the larger publishing houses, it gives you a credibility. But not only does it give you a credibility, you know, you will have somebody who is really experienced in the industry edit your work. There is nothing more valuable than a really experienced industry professional editing your work. You will learn so much.
So much.
You know, I've been really lucky to have Pelgrane Press edit some of the things that I've done. And every time I send something into them, they just give me the best feedback. And every bit of feedback is making me a better designer. And so that's what I'd say to people is, don't be afraid of editors. Editors are your friend. They are the people who are going to make you the best game designer you can be.
And the same goes if you're just writing articles or fiction or nonfiction. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really matter. Trust your editor, irregardless of what you're doing, because
yeah,
they're just trying to make you look as good as physically possible.
It's true. You know, I never felt at any point with any of the things that I was writing that somebody was trying to dilute my creativity. All they were trying to do was help me transmit my ideas in a way that other people would best understand. So I think that if you can get even a small amount of work writing from the big publishing houses, that can be a really good thing in terms of some grabbing some really good experience and some really good feedback. But equally, I would say, you know, think about if you want to design and kickstart and publish your own games, because it's just so easy now to do that. You know, you don't have to run a big complicated Kickstarter. You can just put it up, you know, just pay what you want on Drive-Thru, or publish it on your website. But I think that once you get over that initial fear of putting something out there, that's really important. You know, it's a really good thing to get over that fear, and there might be some consequences and some kickback. And we've certainly had reviews of Lovecraft-esque that were less than stellar. But you know what? Putting anything out into the world is a vulnerable thing to do, but it's a really good thing to do, because if people weren't making art and they weren't putting it out there, then this world would be a pretty dull place. And if you can be a part of that kind of that creative movement, I think that's a really good thing to do.
Now, you mentioned earlier Graham and Kat Tobin from Pelgrane. Are there any other people that kind of helped form the way that you write or the way that you go about game design in general?
Oh, probably millions of people. I think that everybody I've played with over the years has probably touched my game design in some way. People I've spoken to on G+, and, you know, articles that I've read, podcasts that I've listened to have probably all, you know, come into this melting pot of my brain. I think the person who probably has the most influence on my game design is Josh, because he sits across the living room from me and says things like, I don't understand what you wrote there. That doesn't make any sense. And I reread it and I go, no, you're right about that. Or he'll say, that thing that bit you're about to cut out, you should keep that bit in. That's really good. And so, yeah, the definitely apart from kind of Graham and Kat, the person who has the most influence on me is Josh, just because of the kind of the symbiotic nature of the way that we design. I hope he'd say the same about me. I hope so.
He's in trouble if he doesn't. Before you were writing for any of the big publishing houses like Pelgrane or whoever, and you were just doing stuff on Black Armada, did you find it more difficult to actually get things into or to submit things to Pelgrane, or was it more of a mental block? Was it an industry block because you haven't written for a major thing and Lovecraft Desk hasn't come out yet? Or was it because you just had this mental block where you just didn't want to take the risk for rejection of whatever the personal demon might be that held you back?
It's kind of hard to say, because I ended up getting When the Dark Is Gone published via Pelgrane, because it turned out I knew some people who knew Kat really well, and they had played When the Dark Is Gone and they had mentioned it to her. So when I approached her and said, oh, I see that you're running this event about this type of mechanics. I can't come to the event, but I've written a game with that sort of mechanics. You know, it's here if you'd like to read it, if that would be interesting to you. And that's kind of how that relationship started. I don't think it occurred to me to pitch anything to any of the big publishing houses, because, why didn't it occur to me? I think it was just one of those, it was a more of a mental block. It just kind of felt like, that's for other people. You know, other people do that, and I'm just sitting here in my quiet corner and putting things on Black Armada, which only my friends read. So it's very low risk, isn't it? You know, only the kind of a handful of people or so that I went to university with who still read my website are ever going to look at it. So it's very low risk. And I don't know. I think particularly with When the Dark Is Gone, I did genuinely send it to her to say, this is a mechanic that you're talking about, it might be interesting, because it had never occurred to me that Pelgrane would publish something like When the Dark Is Gone, because it was a very kind of weird pseudo LARP game. It certainly wasn't a Trail of Cthulhu or a Hill Folk. And then they did publish it, and at the same time we were doing Lovecraft Desk. And I think that when we did Lovecraft Desk, part of the decision certainly came from seeing so many indie Kickstarters succeed and thinking, well, you know, if they can do it, we might as well have a go.
I mean, a lot of indie Kickstarters aren't as good as Lovecraft Desk.
That's very kind.
It's a good game, I mean, all the way around. Did getting Pelgrane to publish that, did that kind of bolster you in your feelings for Lovecraft Desk, since you are doing them side by side, or since it was published and or picked up by them at the same time you're doing the Lovecraft Desk Kickstarter?
Yeah, absolutely. It kind of gave me a sense of, I kind of vacillated, actually. I remember, you know, before When the Dark Is Gone got picked up by Pelgrane, I was, you know, imposter syndrome. I was thinking, well, I've written this thing, but let's face it, it's not good enough to publish. And then Pelgrane did publish it. And I remember having an email conversation with Kat when I said, my imposter syndrome has now moved on to, you've published my game and it's made a massive loss for you because nobody wanted to buy it. So I did vacillate quite a lot around that. But I think that getting Pelgrane to pick it up, having people edit it and feeling that I was improving as a writer absolutely helped me with my confidence for Lovecraft Desk, and thinking, no, actually, this isn't all in my head. This isn't all in our head, me and Josh. This is something here. And I remember that when we came up with the leaping to conclusions mechanic, I remember that moment in particular being a bit of a mental breakthrough for us in terms of thinking, oh, no, this game is really something now, because we have children, we have busy jobs. Part of how the indie movement ended up attracting Josh and I so much was that so many of the games don't require prep. And back when I was in my 20s running the Society Game, spending the equivalent of a part-time job preparing games every single week while I was a student, you know, what else was I going to do? Work on my degree, you know. but I had the luxury of time, and Josh had the luxury of time. And then we got really attracted to the indie movement because so many of the games didn't require you to put that level of time in that we just simply no longer had. But we both really craved that satisfying mystery and denouement that you get in Lovecraft stories, that you have this finale where all of the clues are revealed to tell you what was going on all along, and it's awful and brilliant and that sort of thing. And so we really still loved mystery games, and we really still craved a satisfying mystery. And kind of our big design challenge for Lovecraft Desk was, how do you create a GMless, prepless game that has a satisfying mystery that when all is revealed, the mystery is consistent with all of the clues that have been revealed. And it feels like that was the solution all along. And we spent ages and ages tackling this. And I remember when we came up with this leaping to conclusion mechanic, thinking, gosh, well, if we have cracked that design goal of how do we make a mystery that is completely improvised at the table feel like it was designed all along and feel like it was prepped all along, then that is brilliant. And to be honest, if that is all we had achieved and the Kickstarter had fallen flat on its face, I would still be overwhelmingly proud of Lovecraft Esque.
You should be, honestly. It's a great game. Do you have any advice specifically, since this is Women in Tabletop Gaming Month, do you have any advice specifically for women or girls who are looking to write for their favorite game or game system or design their own?
Yeah, I think firstly, don't underestimate that you're probably going to bring something really fresh to the table and something really fresh to the game, because there still aren't that many women out designing for some of the bigger titles. There are some fabulous women in the industry, but there aren't quite as many as I would like to see. There isn't parity. And so your ideas are going to just have faith that your ideas and your angles are going to be something different. My biggest mistake for the longest time was thinking that I had to design lists of encumbrance tables and knowing that I couldn't do it. And that made me feel like I can't be a game designer. And it was when I saw Fiasco and I saw game design being done a completely different way, I thought, well, hang on a minute. If Fiasco can tear up the rule book in that direction, I can tear up the rule book and design a tabletop, which is a stealth LARP, because I know how to design one of those. And when that door was opened for me, that realization that the rule book had actually been completely torn up, and then coming back to first principles and saying, well, if I was going to design any game that I could design, if I could do anything that I could do, something that plays to my strengths as a GM, the thing that I really enjoy when I'm playing, what would that look like? And I will make my system and my mechanics laser focus on bringing those things out. And so that's the advice I would say to people, that, particularly if they're looking to design their own stuff, is that don't think you have to kind of squeeze yourself into a retro clone of Dungeons & Dragons system or Trail of Cthulhu system or any of the big titles. If that is not what is making you sing, if that's not where your strengths are, your strengths could be designing something like Fiasco or Bluebeard's Bride or some of these other titles which are doing very, very weird and interesting things. And that is just as interesting and important as the more established titles. I think that was a huge kind of awakening moment for me, in kind of spending the longest time thinking that I couldn't be a game designer, and then realizing that that's because I had internalized this very narrow conception of game. And I do want to say that, you know, I still love playing things like Trail and the big titles. You know, I really love Trail in particular, but I would not be able to sit down and write that game. But that's okay. That's okay.
So what are you doing now? I know Lovecraft Esque is out, and y'all just went to UK Games Expo. How did you do?
We did pretty well. We teamed up with three other small press indie publishers who are all based in the UK. One of the things that we've been talking about with the other game publishers for a little while now is that there is a really fantastic network for indie game publishers in America. And we don't have quite that level of networking in the UK. And that's a real shame, because it's a really tiny community over here. And so we've got together with UFO Press, Certain Death Games, and Rowan, Rook and Deckard. And we took a stall together at UK Games Expo. And we all still liked each other at the end of the weekend. And so that was a real success. And we had a really good time doing that. So what's next is I've got a Kickstarter planned probably for the end of this year, maybe beginning of next year, depending on, I'm hoping it'll be the end of this year, but it's always kind of hard to tell whether life events will kind of knock you off your trajectory. But so far, end of this year, beginning of next year, which is a game about werewolves.
Oh.
So I love White Wolf's werewolf game, but it just doesn't hit the spot for me. It just, the White Wolf system doesn't quite do the thing that I want it to do. So I've written Bite Me, which is a Powered by the Apocalypse game about the life of the emotional life of being in a werewolf pack and what that's like. So I'm hoping to get that out by the end of into Kickstarter by the end of the year. That's in playtesting at the moment. That is in external playtesting at the moment. So that's when I have to sit back and cross my fingers that that it isn't just awful.
That sounds really interesting. I'm interested to see that because I was a fan of White Wolf back in the day as well. But as well, it doesn't quite tick all my boxes these days. You know, it did 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But you know, these days it doesn't.
I spent many a Saturday night wandering around Oxford in crushed velvet. So,
I did the same thing only in Texas.
Texas is a very hot place for that.
You're not joking. Which is, I think, subconsciously was one reason why we were playing like Vampire the Masquerade, because it was a dark and it wasn't quite as hot. You could get away with it.
That is a really good idea. I feel very blessed when I was playing Vampire the Masquerade for a number of reasons, but partly because we were playing as part of Oxford University Role Playing Society, and the big perk of going to Oxford, if you are a student society in Oxford back then, was you could hire student college rooms for free.
Oh, wow.
And if you can imagine some of the amazing Baroque rooms with, you know, kind of piano, grand pianos in them and fabulous paintings and things strewn across Oxford University.
Any room at any college?
No, not any room in any college. It had to be somebody in the society who was at the college. We had a good spread and we had some beautiful rooms, and I have played in some of the vampire in some of the most beautiful places in Oxford.
Oh, that's amazing. We were left to like the local park or something, you know, something just horrible. The ambiance was not the same, my dear, I have to say. Nowhere near close. So just going off the rails now. Favorite clan when you did play?
Oh, Bruja. Always Bruja.
La Sombra. In Titrebue or otherwise, I didn't care. There was something about the inky darkness that I just really enjoyed.
The only good thing about being in the Camarilla is rebelling against it.
I liked doing Sabbat, but nobody would. It was because of the way it was initially put forward in the original release of Vampire the Masquerade in the first edition. A lot of my friends didn't want to be, they were set apart as like the enemy, you know, and it was very much Camarilla focused. And so we were kind of pigeonholed into Camarilla, whether I wanted to or not. So I typically did La Sombra and Titrebue, which was the turncoat La Sombra that came over. but you know, I just couldn't get away from that. You know, the ability to manipulate shadow in that way, you know, it's great. Even against an angry Bruja.
Especially against an angry Bruja. Take them down a peg or two.
Not true Bruja, though. Those are a whole different issue.
That is a very, very different space to be in. And Josh has a Kickstarter coming out. Oh, gosh, I think he's due in about 6 weeks now, actually. So that's why he's looking... He's dragging me off and asking me to look at art and tell me what my view is and things.
What is his?
It's called Flotsam. I think it's got some aspects of Dream Askew and some aspects of his Hillfolk in it. When you're sort of playing it's the renegades and misfits in the underbelly of a spaceship. So if you can imagine down below in Babylon 5.
Yeah, like Bill's rats, essentially.
Yeah. Exactly. The people who are kind of scavenging a living at the very kind of lowest decks of a spaceship.
There was a whole class devoted to that in like the Rogue Trader Dark Heresy Warhammer 40K RPG that Fantasy Flight put out.
The longest role-playing game that Josh and I were in together was his Warhammer 40K. Ooh. Yeah, he ran for 5 years.
Was it Dark Heresy or Rogue Trader or Imperium? Or
it was Dark Heresy, and we had each person in the game had two characters. So we had kind of low level street investigators, and he there was a lot of H.P. Lovecraft influences in the way that he ran the campaign. And then when we really needed to fight something big and scary, we all had Adeptus Sororitas characters.
Oh. I love that game. I really do. I just enjoy combat in that game because it is utterly brutal.
Yeah, it's very, very brutal. Very brutal.
It brings up that part of playing Lovecraftian games where as a GM you get to just completely jack with your players, but now you get to just jack with them in combat. I just really enjoy that. Is there anything you wanted to talk about that I haven't brought up?
I don't know. I think the hardest thing really in terms of if there are women or non-binary people out there who really want to break in, is that it's still a lot of networking. I think it's still a lot about making contacts and getting to know people. And thanks to social media and the internet, that is a little bit more flat. But that's, you know, I kind of feel in a way that I just kind of lucked out because I knew somebody who knew somebody, and that's probably... but I don't know if that's the sort of thing I want to say on the show to people, because then it's like, well, is that really very helpful, you know?
Well, I mean, it is, though. Knowing people is half the game in this battle. I mean, honestly, if you don't have an easy way in, knowing somebody who has a way in is your easy way in.
That's true.
I mean, it's the same with us. You know, I know enough people through doing this show that I have... that I'm able to call up somebody like you and say, hey, let's talk for an hour.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's great. And I love it.
I think the one of the things that I would say is that get your stuff out there and publish it, even if it's just on a website or on a blog, because you never know who's going to come across it. And certainly now, one of the things that I always do, if I'm doing something, we did this with Lovecraft Desk. We do this with all of our Kickstarters, even though, you know, I still don't really consider myself having broken into the industry particularly because I haven't done that much stuff. But if I'm looking for stretch goal authors or if I want art for my project, I will often put out a call on social media to my network saying, do you know of anybody up and coming who I can support to get something, even something quite small, out? And I've certainly kind of talked to, say, you know, Graham Walmsley has given us the names of people in the past, and so has Jason Morningstar. You know, when I've gone to them and said, are there people that you are watching who I could ask to do this? Because I'm not here to pull the drawbridge up after myself. You know, I am here to say I have had some really lucky breaks when I do projects. I want to find other people who are also trying to get in, who could do with a helping hand and the lucky breaks that I had and that sort of thing. So, yeah, so I suppose my biggest piece of advice would be to women and non-binary people and any other marginalized people, you know, put your stuff out there, respond to calls for open calls for art or things like that, because a lot of the time somebody might be putting that call out there because they are specifically hoping to find somebody who is undiscovered or who, you know, who they could help. And we had so much help from so many people when we did Lovecraft Desk, and we are always looking to pay that forward. And I think a lot of people in the industry are looking to pay that forward. So getting yourself out there, putting your games out there, even if it's just on drive-through or, you know, print on demand, pay what you want stuff, then at least when that call comes through, you can say, well, here's the thing that I did. Because if you haven't written anything, then you haven't got anything to show anybody.
Exactly. That's brilliant advice, honestly. Becky Anderson, thank you so much for coming on. What is the website addresses so everybody knows where to find you?
We're at www.blackarmada.com.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We want to hear from our listeners, and we have lots of ways you can reach out to us.
For the complete list, check out our show notes. That's where you'll find our email address, which is mup.feedback@gmail.com, as well as the phone number, SpeakPipe link, and our forums.
Send us your questions, feedback, and topic ideas, or join us.
Are we in a race, Chad? Slow it down.
There's no outtakes in this one, so let's not milk it. Come on. Send us your questions, feedback, and topic ideas, or join a discussion, record a liner, tell us who you are, and give us a hearty go pods for our home team, the Fightin' Cephalopods.
Find all the links you need to keep in touch at mu-podcast.com/149.
Thank you for joining us for another episode. Class is dismissed.
The Call of Cthulhu role-playing game is property of Chaosium, Inc. The written works of H.P. Lovecraft are held in the United States public domain. All other works mentioned in this podcast are the property of their respective owners. Original content of this show is copyright of the Miskatonic University Podcast under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license.
Did you... Oh, I just lost my question. That evaporated right out of my head. What the hell was I going to ask? This is going to be edited, by the way.
That's fine.
Sound absolutely pristine, because I trust my audio editors as well. Oh, Chad, you hear that? I love you, man.